Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain, and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
For 120 years, Mount Carmel College of Nursing has prepared nurses to serve our communities. Here, our students can earn their Bachelor of Science in Nursing degree and take their education all the way to a Doctor of Nursing practice with small class sizes and help every step of the way. Want to learn more? Visit mccn.edu/visit to schedule your campus visit today. That's mccn.edu/visit.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch Argus, a
good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, death and dying across the centuries and how people prepared to depart this life, the attempt by Bertrand Russell and other intellectuals to put the United States on trial for the Vietnam War, and to end the show, whether Alexander the Great was a genius, a tyrant, a dreamer, a killer, a visionary, or a maniac. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with death and dying across the centuries. History is dominated by the deaths of leading figures. Queens beheaded, archdukes assassinated. But what about everyone else? How did ordinary people depart this life and grieve for loved ones? And which of the old ways might help prepare us for the end? Well, a groundbreaking new work of social history paints a rich picture of the lives of our forebears, skillfully bringing the lost art of death to life today. The book is called No Ordinary Deaths: A People's History of Mortality. It's published in hardback by the Wellcome Collection. The author is Molly Connesby. And Molly, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks very much for having me, Patrick.
Can we talk first of all about the concept behind the book, this idea of celebrating and studying the deaths of ordinary people rather than just the famous people?
Yes, absolutely. When I studied history at school, the Grim Reaper hovered over our lessons. We learned about the Tudors, we learned about the World Wars and so on. But these lessons were always framed through kind of the famous people, archdukes assassinated, kings and queens, and the impact that their deaths had on politics and society. And the thing that really interested me as a young person studying history was how everybody else fared, I suppose. I had grandparents, for example, who served in World War II, but we never learned about the experience of you know, everyday lives and deaths that they witnessed through their experience of being at war. So I think I wanted to approach the whole aspect of lives, ordinary lives, everyday lives, of which there is a kind of rich historiographical tradition, but also to look at the other end, to look at death and to look at how people coped with what we all know were very, very high levels of mortality, often well into the early 20th century. And I sort of wondered how that kind of played out in terms of everyday life. So, as I say, we knew the impact of kings and queens and their deaths on society. But how did a community cope with, I don't know, high levels of child mortality, for example? So that was the kind of motivation behind the book. And I think it's been, it was a sort of seed growing in me from school onwards, really. I loved my history lessons, but I really wanted to know about day-to-day life. And as an extension of that, also about day-to-day death.
And death seems to have been a lot more visible then. People would have experienced, seen it more around them growing up. It's much rarer now for children, say, to see corpses.
That's right. I mean, these days we tend to die in care settings, so maybe hospitals, hospices, care homes and so on. Although the vast majority of people express the wish to die at home. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, that doesn't prove to be possible. So we're less familiar because until well into the 20th century, really certainly in the UK context, until the foundation of the NHS, we were far more likely to die at home and we would have been cared for by family and friends and sometimes professional help paid for and brought in. And that sort of gave death maybe a more domestic face because people were caring for people at the end of life and also caring for the body after death. So again, that would be done often within the family or friends. Bodies would be washed and dressed and prepared for the funeral. Sometimes I have grandparents who can remember bodies being laid out in the parlour and the neighbours coming round to pay their last respects and so on. So in a sense, death was much more integrated into the domestic realm, a much more day-to-day experience.
You mentioned earlier about infant mortality and about how it, what really giving birth and being a child in these early years was such a difficult thing and such a challenging thing to survive into adulthood. How did families cope and deal with such a high rate of infant mortality?
Historians have claimed that perhaps parents didn't get quite so attached to small children in the past as we do now because of the high levels of infant mortality. But I have to say, I don't think I've found any historiographical evidence of that at all. I think there's plenty of evidence that parents were just as bereaved when they went through the horror of losing a child. I think particularly sort of by the late 18th and 19th century when Britain was urbanising, so lots of people were migrating from countryside into cities. The intensity of urban life, high density population, poor sewerage, poor diets, unhealthy polluted air and so on, had a huge impact on child mortality. So in some urban areas, you're looking at, 50% plus child mortality. So that's children dying before the age of two or three. And I think that must have had an enormous impact on families. If you think about it, if you think about the average person who was maybe sort of born late 18th century, lived through till the mid 19th century, they would have spent an awful lot of their time in grief, bereaved. They may well have lost siblings growing up. They may well have lost parents fairly young and then lost numbers of their own children. And I think it must have had devastating emotional consequences. On the other hand, I think it also inspired quite a lot of social solidarity, mutual support. There were thousands of burial clubs, for example, so communities, this is an era before the welfare state, communities banding together to support each other through hard times, through a bereavement or unemployment, by paying a few pence a week into a kind of socialised local fund that could be drawn upon if you had to suddenly pay for a funeral, for example. And I think also the fact that people related to each other's losses. There's a great deal of evidence when we scour the archives and so on that because so many people lost young children, for example, they knew how to support each other perhaps better because there was a sort of mutually shared experience. So, for example, I had a colleague who very unfortunately lost a young child, and she told me that people would sort of cross the road to avoid speaking to her because perhaps they were anxious they would say the wrong thing or they might sort of trigger some emotion in her. And she's a very understanding and compassionate person and really understood why people were avoiding her. But I remember reflecting after that conversation that simply wouldn't have happened in the 18th and 19th century, I don't believe, because so many people would have shared that experience of losing a child or losing a loved one or losing a sibling, that there would have been, I think, perhaps a stronger bond of solidarity and recognition of the experience of that grief and loss.
Some fascinating traditions, and maybe even you might call them superstitions. For example, the idea of using feathers to perhaps hold them back until loved ones could say their farewells, or perhaps using pigeons as messengers, that the feathers might symbolise some kind of spiritual release.
Yes, absolutely. Lots and lots of traditions around dying and death and end of life, some of which seem fairly consistent. So there seems to have been a fairly consistent need to open a window after someone had died so that the soul, we believe the belief was that so that the soul could kind of pass out of the house. If you were removing a body from a house, to remove it feet first so it couldn't walk back, the restless spirit couldn't walk back. You have to remember that for our ancestors, the period between dying and death wasn't always a really clear-cut matter. Because they didn't have stethoscopes or any kind of modern techniques in order to ascertain whether somebody had actually died or not. You know, they might use a feather to the lips to see if the feather moved or a glass or a mirror to the lips. But there wasn't a sort of scientific definition of death as such. So there was this sort of liminal, perhaps dangerous time right at the end of life when devils and angels might be competing for your soul. So it was often believed that various things had to be done in order to preserve the kind of sanctity of the soul and ensure it went to purgatory or to heaven. So there were things like opening the window. Some customs were veiling mirrors and so on after somebody had died. You touched on their feathers. Feathers have a mixed role at the end of life. Some people believe they could hold the body back. So if someone was having an agonizing death, you might lift them off the feathers, off a feather mattress to expedite their end. Others believing that feathers, as you've said, could help as a messenger, send the soul forward. The interesting thing about folklore and traditions is they're often incredibly local. So literally a village might have its own traditions around end of life, and that might be, you know, completely different from the next village. And that's what's so rich and fascinating about studying the subject of end of life and dying and death and a so-called ordinary death, is that it was so different practices, different beliefs, different rituals according to community, many of the origins of which are probably sort of lost in time. Some of the more romantic ideas around death ritual, there's a story you may have heard of called the Sin Eater, and it was believed in some communities that someone in the village, usually a sort of marginalized figure, might be paid in bread and ale to eat bread over the corpse. So that the sin eater would literally take on the sins of the person who had died. Now, I used to love this story, but very sadly, a wonderful folklorist historian, Helen Frisby, I know, has researched this in great detail and thinks it's probably a figment of the kind of romantic imagination, which is a little bit disappointing. So every now and then we come across a ritual and we think, oh, that sounds absolutely fascinating, but it doesn't have truth at its core. But certainly, you know, locals had their own rituals and rites that they practiced and their own relationship to things that they thought were right and proper to do for the dead.
And what about faith? How important was faith for people and in terms of dealing with death and bereavement?
Faith is a really, really fascinating subject. And it's very hard for us as historians to kind of go back into the past and really drill under what people actually believed. You know, how do we define belief and how do people kind of interact with what they believe? So it's a really kind of rich area, I think, of research. And I know research around the emotions is a really kind of important and growing area in our field. I think the truth is it was probably different for different people. And of course, certainly in the English and Scottish and Welsh context, it changed profoundly with the Reformation. So up to that point, Catholic practice had been very much based around a sort of contract, if you like, between the living and the dead. So when somebody died, if they passed into purgatory, they were really reliant on the living community to remember them, to hold masses, and to kind of hold them and pray for them to then expedite their journey into heaven. And when the Reformation came, that caused an enormous, enormous emotional rupture for people who, you know, what happened to their dead? You know, once the Protestant reformers came through and said, no, there's no such thing as purgatory. You don't need to pray for the dead. You don't need masses. You don't need all of these rituals. This left an enormous gaping hole for people who were left behind, who cleaved to what were the old ways. And I think, again, this boils into my interest in ordinary deaths again, everyday history, is we don't think about what the emotional impact on communities must have been of the Reformation. It's been absolutely seismic, a tectonic shift in how they were supposed to view the world. And I think the kind of growth, the great growth of nonconformist religion in the 18th and 19th century as well, many of those religions developed their own rituals and thoughts around end of life and death and how to care for the dying and dead, and were a matter of great sort of comfort to people at the end of life. There's a chapter in the book where I talk about a young printer from Newcastle called Thomas Angus, who died in 1808. And he was a Baptist, and he was deeply comforted by a Baptist minister in the last weeks and days of his life. And we know this because the Baptists and the Methodists, because they were peripatetic religions, they kept quite detailed notes and articles and printed journals about faith experiences so that they could share what was going on within their community within what was quite a dispersed geographical community. And Thomas Angus sort of confessed to his priest his feelings at the end of life, and he talked about his anxieties about dying, but he also talked about coming into the light and seeing Jesus. His revelations were recorded carefully in the Baptist magazine, and Baptist magazine and the Methodist magazine both used to print deathbed scenes like this because they were seen as being really inspirational to the wider Baptist and Methodist community. Deathbed scenes were incredibly important. It was really important to have this narrative around the struggle for the end of life, and but also the seeing of the light and the coming of the light. And it was meant to inspire other people of the same faith that even though their end might feel difficult, that actually faith would triumph. And it was really, these are amazing, actually, everyday accounts of deathbeds, of dying and death. They're such a rich resource. Women, children, as well as men, had their last words recorded. And it feels like a sort of into almost sort of authentic first-hand accounts. I mean, of course, the accounts were written by people who had an interest in portraying the dying person as a person of the faith. But nonetheless, I think the language used feels sort of authentic enough that you can imagine Thomas Angus, this young man, this young printer who I think was probably dying of tuberculosis, reading between the lines, you know, really struggling at the end, really struggling with his faith, but actually coming back to the church right at the end and being ready to be embraced into the arms of Jesus. So I think for in the past, I think religion was huge comfort. We have to remember in our modern medicalized dying and death, you know, we have lots of access to, you know, anti-anxiety drugs, pain relief and so on. And in the past, our ancestors didn't have access to that. They had to rely on their faith. They had to rely on their stoicism, on the support of the people around them. And faith, for those that had it, must have been an enormous comfort, I would imagine, to people at the end and in the agonies.
You also had public executions, and that was also a way that people could experience death and view death.
Yes, absolutely. Public executions were hugely popular events. I mean, a way that might feel sort of slightly ghoulish to us today. Thousands of people would turn out to watch hangings at Tyburn Tree in London, for example. And many communities, if you walk even into the rural areas now, you might pass something called Gallows Lane or Gallows Fields, which is an indicator that perhaps there were executions held there also in the past. And these were huge public events. They were quite interesting. They're quite nuanced, really, because they're about the kind of visual representation of power, for example. So particularly during the 18th century, you know, the punishment on the body if you'd done something wrong. And I have to say there were hundreds of crimes that you could be executed for by the mid 18th century. You know, things that might feel relatively trivial for us today, like, you know, a bit of thievery and so on, could actually be a hanging offence. And these events were mass spectacles. People would come and drink. There would be broadside sellers selling poems and songs about the people about to be executed. You would get an account from the prison priest, the ordinary, telling the misdeeds of the people to be executed. So a huge sort of entertainment industry really grew around executions. And even after the event, if crimes were particularly notorious, not only could you buy broadsides, poems and so on, you might be able to buy pottery figures, for example, of murder victims or their murderers. So it was a huge sort of popular culture around executions, which, as I say, may feel a bit sort of, oh, to us today, may feel a bit ghoulish. But on the other hand, we mustn't forget in our own time, there is a thriving and quite popular dark tourism, thanatourism, it's sometimes called, where people go and specifically go and look at sites where notorious murders have taken place or notorious crimes. Another thing to bear in mind about public executions is that sometimes criminals became popular folk heroes. There's a famous case of a guy called Jack Shepherd, Honest Jack, who in the early 18th century, he was a thief. He managed to escape from prison four times. And on the fourth time, he wasn't so lucky and was executed in London. And from what I read, 250,000 people turned out to see his hanging. He was an incredibly popular figure and they were chanting his name. He was seen as a bit of a Robin Hood figure. So the crowd were kind of very for him. They were chanting and celebrating his execution. Bear in mind that 250,000 people at that time was nearly half the population of London. So nearly half the population of London turned out to see this sort of rather amazing spectacle of this popular figure who was being executed.
Do you think there's things that we can learn from the past that might help us prepare for when we have to get ready for death, or perhaps something that we can learn about how we should deal with people who are recently bereaved?
I think there are things that we can learn from the past. I think there is something around the mutualism and the solidarity that people showed around the dying and the dead and those that had cared for them. I think that's a really, for me, a very moving element of actually doing this research, is the way that communities built solidarities around care for the dying. And that wasn't just through things like burial clubs, which socialised the cost of things like funerals or medical care. It was also about filing in to come and visit the dead, having a moment with them, sitting with the people who were bereaved, acknowledging their loss and acknowledging the loss that the community also experienced. And I think wakes now, I mean, I know not in all cultures, certainly not in Ireland and so on, but wakes now are usually held after a funeral when the person is no longer there, they've been buried or cremated. Whereas there's something to me very powerful and rather beautiful about sitting with the body, normalising, accepting that they have gone, but also celebrating them as part of that process. And the death positive movement, which is a sort of movement that is trying to sort of work to help us kind of embrace the idea of end of life and to celebrate it as well as be sad, is quite keen now on encouraging relatives, for example, to get involved in washing and dressing bodies ready for death. Or even keeping the body at home for a few days so that you can come to terms with the loss. So I think that's a really powerful lesson that we can learn. I think also the compassion that was often shown for the bereaved in the past is something really powerful that we can learn from. I think the way that perhaps unintentionally sometimes modern therapeutic language has kind of pathologized, I think, perhaps people who are in grief and, oh, you know, you've got to move on and so on. And I don't think that would have been the sort of language that people would have used in the past. I think they would have understood the power of grief. I've seen coroner's records that put grief as a cause of death and doctor's death certification. So people really understood the kind of disordering, the power that grief could have on the living, on those left behind. And I think it was probably because more people experience bereavement more directly, more viscerally, more in the home, as we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, there was perhaps an ability to empathise more, to hold a space for people who were grieving. I know it's sort of fashionable these days to mock some of the more ridiculous aspects of, for example, Victorian mourning, you know, people dressing dramatically in black and veils and Whitby jet jewellery and so on. But actually what that did do was give you a very sort of visual reminder of somebody's loss, of somebody's grief. And I'm not at all proposing that, you know, we return to the days of Queen Victoria's widow's weeds, but I think there is something there for me about really holding a space and compassion for people who are bereaved.
And it's fascinating the way you do take the story from the medieval period right up to more recent times, and how real people prepared for death and cared for those who were dying, that there's so many changes in terms of traditions, beliefs, in terms of how things were approached, that it's almost, you get to see the full range of society changing through this study.
Absolutely. And people in the book lived through tectonic shifts, you know, huge economic, social changes, the rise of capitalism, the rise of urbanisation, wars, and so on. So, of course, all of those things impacted on how people died. I mean, literally down to the kinds of deaths on things people died of. So by the 19th century, of course, you're getting much more industrial deaths. I looked at some urban coroner's records over the course of the 19th century. And of course, you can almost map the rise of industrialization on the coroner's records, because the number of people dying from industrial accidents or the kinds of collateral things you might get from working, you know, sort of dusty lungs from working, you know, in anything from bakery to farming. So you get this kind of sense of how we have always had to cope with novel and changing kinds of deaths, new diseases arriving, like cholera, for example. Now, cholera wasn't a new disease in the 1830s, but it was certainly new to Britain, and terrifying, you know, came with this sort of terrifying fanfare from Europe, you know, this awful disease that could fell the fit and healthy within hours and in a most horrible way. So we've always had to cope with novel diseases, and I suppose we've experienced it collectively recently with COVID. Now we're coming up to the sort of fifth anniversary of lockdowns and so on. So our relationship to dying and death has shifted. It does shift. It moves with the times. And of course, it's a fundamental. Death and taxes, you know, as the old joke has it, is a fundamental. But our actual relationship to how we're dying also changes over time, and our rituals in response to that. If you look at the way our death rituals had to change around COVID, for example, with people having socially distanced funerals, for example, with very limited numbers of people, we sort of adapted to that for that particular period. So whilst there are timeless elements around dying and death, there are also really fascinating ways in which it kind of evolves with the times that we're in.
Well, my thanks to Molly Connesby. She's the author of this brilliant new book, No Ordinary Deaths, A People's History of Mortality. It's published in hardback by Wellcome Collection. And Molly, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
What makes a leader? It's a tough question, but this we know for sure. True leaders lead by example. They take risks and plunge into life with determination. And for real leaders, there's a symbol of high adrenaline and high achievement, the Range Rover Sport. The Range Rover Sport redefines sporting luxury with a dramatic modern design that meets a distinctive sporting character. And a well-appointed cabin brings a sense of occasion to every drive. The active noise cancellation feature filters out unwanted sound, making the cabin a cocoon-like sanctuary. Optional PM2.5 filtration reduces odors, bacteria, and allergens, while CO2 management enhances the wellness of everyone on board. Plus, you can curate the mood of every journey with configurable cabin lighting, and bring a hint of refinement to every drive with optional 22-way adjustable heated and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Build your Range Rover Sport at rangerover.com/us/sport. That's rangerover.com/us/sport.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.
For
For 120 years, Mount Carmel College of Nursing has prepared nurses to serve our communities. Here, our students can earn their Bachelor of Science in Nursing degree and take their education all the way to a Doctor of Nursing practice with small class sizes and help every step of the way. Want to learn more? Visit mccn.edu/visit to schedule your campus visit today. That's mccn.edu/visit.
Welcome back. We're talking history. In a new book, award-winning historian Clive Webb lays bare the extraordinary true story of the 1967 Russell Tribunal and its attempts to hold the US government to account for atrocities in the Vietnam War. The book is called Viet Damned: How the World's Greatest Minds Put America on Trial. It's published in hardback by Profile Books. The author, as I say, Clive Webb. And Clive, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Patrick.
Can we begin by maybe setting the scene for this extraordinary tribunal? Who was involved and what was it trying to do?
The person who was the principal architect of the tribunal was the philosopher and political activist Bertrand Russell. And he was aided and abetted by Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. Those were the three principal kind of intellectual forces behind it. And there, along with them, was a coterie of intellectuals, activists, lawyers who were involved in the tribunal. Their purpose was to expose what they believed were war crimes being committed by the US military in Vietnam, to try to stir the conscience, the collective conscience, really, of the American people in particular, but of a broader international audience, in order to try to seek an end to the conflict, really, and a restoration of what they saw fundamentally as the, you know, as the kind of the human rights of Vietnamese civilians that they believed were being violated.
And Bertrand Russell had a lifelong commitment to peace and justice going back many decades.
Yeah, it's worth remembering that Russell at this time was in his 90s. He'd lived a long and an illustrious life, and he'd been a peace activist since the First World War, when he'd been a conscientious objector and he'd been imprisoned because of his beliefs. He had taken a different stand during the Second World War, which he had seen as a necessary conflict to put an end to fascism. But the Cold War had really reignited his concern about the threat to world peace, especially the fact that we were now living in the nuclear age, and he saw the Vietnam conflict as a potential catalyst for another global conflict involving nuclear weapons, should the Chinese or the Russians become involved directly in a clash with the United States.
This tribunal had no legal power or legal authority, so why did the American government care about it?
I think they cared about it because they were concerned about controlling the narrative of the war. You know, almost from the outset, the reality of what was going on in Vietnam was being concealed from the American and international audiences. So, you know, and that included, you know, the scale of military troops that were being deployed on the ground, the size of the aerial bombardment, the kind of weaponry that was being used. And the United States was also, because of course, becoming dragged into the quagmire. It was rapidly finding that this was a difficult war to fight. There were no conventional battle fronts. And as a result, you know, a war that Washington had believed it could win quickly and convincingly was turning into a military stalemate. And so there was a lot that the United States wanted to do in order to convince the American people and a broader international audience this was a war worth fighting and that the United States was moving inexorably towards victory. And so this, you know, what they saw was a kind of propaganda exercise by Russell and Sartre to undermine the credibility of the American war effort would have proved very damaging. So they were concerned from the outset to try and stymie the tribunal.
What kind of evidence did the tribunal gather? How credible was it? There does seem to be an impressive array from expert witnesses, to testimony from civilians who had experienced, to people who had visited Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, in one way, one can criticize the tribunal for, it was essentially composed of people who were on the political left, and there was a degree of bias about what they were doing. Certainly that they were intent on proving that the U.S. was committing war crimes and paid little heed to what the North Vietnamese were up to. But that said, they accrued an enormous amount of evidence. They sent investigative teams into North Vietnam to gather evidence about the impact of the bombardment campaign. And they used ballistic experts, medical doctors, journalists, lawyers. There was a whole array of people who were employed by the tribunal to gather evidence. And, you know, and what they found was substantial and telling, you know, some of which was known to, you know, in this kind of, there was an inkling of what was going on in Vietnam, you know, in terms of, for instance, the use of napalm. But there were other aspects of American warfare that really hadn't been exposed before. The most obvious example of that is the use of cluster bombs, which were bombs that spray shrapnel. They had little to no impact upon buildings, but they maimed and killed people. And the U.S. for a long time denied that they were using this kind of weaponry at all. And the tribunal revealed that they were making systematic use of it.
And while it was able to show and demonstrate that war crimes were being committed, what about its attempts to show that the United States was committing genocide, which was much more controversial?
Yes, it was controversial even amongst the members of the tribunal. Russell and Sartre were adamant that this was a genocidal conflict. And I think many of the other tribunals were concerned that that would have a negative impact. You know, the genocide obviously was associated with the Nazi atrocities of the Second World War. And in order to try to persuade the American people to support the anti-war initiative, accusing them by proxy, you know, through their government and their military, of committing genocide was probably counterproductive. Sartre prevailed because he was such a dominant force amongst the members of the tribunal, but it was probably counterproductive, I think, to make that claim. It alienated people who the tribunal really needed to win over, and there's probably more evidence to suggest. You know, there's little evidence to suggest that the U.S. Army was systematically going about attempting to annihilate the Vietnamese people, their culture, their land. You know, that atrocities were committed, but it wasn't without the kind of systematic genocidal design and intent that Sartre supposed. So I think it was a matter of controversy at the time, and probably, as I say, counterproductive.
It's fascinating the way the tribunal was held in Sweden and not in France or Britain, as was originally intended, because we see how political pressure was put on those countries to make sure it wasn't held there.
Yeah, there was enormous pressure placed on foreign governments by Washington to stop them from holding the tribunal. I mean, Paris was the likely location because Sartre and de Beauvoir, obviously French, and French President Charles de Gaulle was also in some respects sympathetic towards the tribunal. But Washington put enormous pressure on other governments to get them to not host the tribunal. And there was, you know, and in Sweden, Tage Erlander, who was the prime minister, was conflicted about it, but he believed that, you know, the freedom of speech laws in Sweden meant that he should go ahead and do it. He too was also placed under a lot of pressure by the US State Department, but went ahead regardless. So Stockholm was not the first choice to hold the tribunal, but it provided a kind of, I think, you know, Sweden as a country was one of the most strongly opposed to the Vietnam War. So it provided a fairly amenable environment, I think, for the tribunal to meet.
Was having so many celebrity intellectuals, perhaps you might call them, involved, was that a double-edged sword? Because it did ensure publicity, but it also had downsides.
It always does. I mean, I think, one can think in a more contemporary context about Hollywood celebrities endorsing Democratic presidential candidates and how that actually tends not to be beneficial to those candidates. But I think, yes, the criticism always was that, you know, these are famous, privileged, wealthy people who are probably out of touch with what's going on the ground. And so, and it also, it made them in a way kind of easy targets because they were public figures. It was very easy for those who were opposed to the tribunal to look at their lives, careers, their public records, and to find what they could to, often as was the case, actually to just slander them and to try to bring them down. So Russell and Sartre in particular were castigated by the press for their opposition to the war. Sartre was dismissed as a kind of, really kind of puppet of the Soviet regime because of his Marxist leanings. And Russell was dismissed as essentially as being kind of geriatric, as being this old man out of touch with reality. So the fact that they were public figures, as you say, was both a blessing and a curse.
Do you think the tribunal was about Russell's need to matter and that it was to a certain extent a vanity project for him, or was it a serious intervention in history?
I think it was both. I think that Russell had been an active figure in international politics for a very long time. There was a satirical cartoon published by Punch magazine, which listed one national, or in fact international, emergency after another, and in whatever it announced, it was always with the notion that Bertrand Russell would stand up and intervene and take a role. And so, you know, I think Russell was, with justification, a man of considerable ego. He was old, his influence was on the wane, and so this was a kind of last opportunity for him to take an active role in international affairs. All of that said, one shouldn't doubt his sincerity. I mean, he is a man who is haunted by the specter of nuclear Armageddon. Absolutely sincere and steadfast in his belief in the need to establish world peace. And as the light is beginning to fade on his life, I think he recognized that this was a last opportunity for him to make a real impact. So it's a combination, Patrick, I think, of the two, a man of a towering ego, undoubtedly, but also somebody who's absolutely sincere in his conviction about the need to try and bring about an end to the war and establish a longer lasting international peace.
How come the tribunal isn't better remembered? It seems to have faded into obscurity. It seems to be largely forgotten.
I think that's because there was such a concerted effort to trash it at the time. The government of Lyndon Johnson in Washington went out of its way to influence the media response in the United States to it. The State Department, for instance, worked with the British journalist Bernard Levin to write basically a hatchet job piece for the New York Times on Russell. And so a lot of the criticisms were made of the personalities of Russell, Sartre, de Beauvoir, et al., rather than focusing on the specific accusations that the tribunal leveled at the US government. And in Britain as well, there was a very negative media reaction. It was more positive elsewhere, it's worth saying. If you look at newspapers in Sweden, in Denmark, in Holland, in France, in Spain, you get a different kind of sense of what's going on in terms of how the media is responding. But I think there was such a concerted effort to try and undermine the tribunal. And the tribunal didn't help itself by being, you know, essentially quite partisan in terms of its political position. So it meant that the tribunal faded quite quickly. It did gain a second life in the 1970s, though, I think. After the media began to expose American war crimes in a more thorough manner, it led to a reevaluation of the tribunal. But even that kind of memory faded over time. I think that the, you know, in a sense that Vietnam was perceived as a tragedy in the United States, but it was largely seen as a tragedy because of the loss of so many American lives, and the impact of what the American military actually did in Vietnam faded from view. And so the tribunal did too.
Given the way the Vietnam War did continue for many years after that, that did later events justify and vindicate perhaps some of their research, some of their investigation and some of their conclusions?
I think it did. The tribunal, in a way, came a little bit too early, in the sense that I don't think in 1967, when they convened, that an international audience was quite ready and willing to accept the claims made by the tribunal. Remember, this is before the exposure of atrocities such as the My Lai massacre, which occurred in 1968, where American Marines went into a village, raped the women, killed everybody. So in a sense that the tribunal can be faulted for having occurred a little bit too soon, at a time when the media hadn't done a more thorough job in exposing American war atrocities and gaining momentum, I think, which would have allowed the tribunal to then flourish in a way that it failed to do so in 1967. That said, I think one can, even if one accepts that the tribunal was to some extent a failure, I think it was an honorable failure, because nothing of its kind had been staged before. And the tribunal was the first body to try to expose some of the darker realities of the Vietnam War. And it deserves, I think, enduring credit for that.
Well, the book is called Viet Damned: How the World's Greatest Minds Put America on Trial. It's published in hardback by Profile Books. The author is Clive Webb. And Clive, thanks a million for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
What makes a leader? It's a tough question, but this we know for sure. True leaders lead by example. They take risks and plunge into life with determination. And for real leaders, there's a symbol of high adrenaline and high achievement, the Range Rover Sport. The Range Rover Sport redefines sporting luxury with a dramatic modern design that meets a distinctive sporting character. And a well-appointed cabin brings a sense of occasion to every drive. The active noise cancellation feature filters out unwanted sound, making the cabin a cocoon-like sanctuary. Optional PM 2.5 filtration reduces odors, bacteria, and allergens, while CO2 management enhances the wellness of everyone on board. Plus, you can curate the mood of every journey with configurable cabin lighting and bring a hint of refinement to every drive with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Build your Range Rover Sport at rangerover.com/US/sport. That's rangerover.com/US/sport.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.
Welcome back. We're Talking History. A new book offers a fresh perspective on the reign of Alexander the Great. It re-examines Alexander's military victories and personality while also exploring the impact of his campaigns on the people he conquered. And it presents an Alexander for the 21st century, offering new insights into how and why historical interpretations of him have changed. The book is called Alexander the Great, Lives and Legacies. It's published in hardback by Reaction Books. The author is Stephen Harrison. And Stephen, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
So what does it mean to write about Alexander the Great in the 21st century? And I suppose in this decade, because it seems that every new generation, every century has its own interpretation, its own view of Alexander.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think one of the fascinating things about Alexander is you can almost read different accounts of Alexander across the different generations, and you just get a sense of how people, how societies have changed and developed in the last 150 years. So I think writing about him in the 2020s and in the 21st century is very different to writing about him sort of 100 years ago. And that has had quite a big effect on the way that I've written the book and the kind of questions that I've wanted to explore. And I think that the root cause of why that's such an issue is because of, you know, there's a massive source problem that just hangs over everything that we say about Alexander the Great, right? The earliest surviving account from antiquity about Alexander was written down more than 300 years after he died. And we've got these kind of five main literary sources who are all writing hundreds of years later. They're writing based on a handful of accounts written by contemporaries, but those have been kind of lost over time. When they were kind of written about by later writers, they were interpreted in different ways. And so it means that actually getting back to the historical Alexander is incredibly difficult. Can I give you one example of the source problem, just to kind of set things up?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, a good example of it concerns the kind of case study of Thebes. So Thebes is this Greek city. And when Alexander first came to power, he went off on a campaign into the north of what's now the Balkans. And while he was away, the city of Thebes rebels against Macedonian control. And Alexander comes back and ultimately ends up flattening the city. But there are different accounts of what happens. So one author, a guy called Diodorus of Sicily, he basically says Alexander turns up, he decides to flatten the city, and that's what he does. The other source is a guy called Arrian. And Arrian writes that Alexander was kind of delaying. He wasn't sure about attacking the city. But then one of the figures in his army, a guy called Perdiccas, he just launches an attack on the battalions of Thebes. He gets into a bit of trouble. Alexander has to send in the whole army to support him. And that leads to the army sacking the city and ultimately destroying it, right? So they're two very different accounts. One of them puts the blame for the destruction of Thebes solely on Alexander. One of them pins it on Perdiccas. So as historians, we would look at this and we'd say, all right, well, where do these guys get their stories from? And Arrian is primarily using a guy called Ptolemy as his source. So Ptolemy is one of Alexander's leading generals, one of his closest friends. So if anyone knows what happens at Thebes, it's Ptolemy, right? So that should make us say, okay, well, Ptolemy's an eyewitness. He knows what's happening. Let's accept Arrian's version. But the problem is, after he dies, Ptolemy writes his account of Alexander's reign, and he's doing that while he's trying to establish himself as the ruler of Egypt. And the very first thing Ptolemy does is he steals the body of Alexander, which is meant to be buried in Macedonia, and buries it in Egypt. And the guy he steals it from is Perdiccas. So when he's writing this account of what happened at Thebes, and he's saying, oh, well, this is Perdiccas' fault, he's essentially blaming one of the most criticized moments on Alexander's reign on his own rival. So then we say, all right, well, okay, there's a real problem. He's got this kind of bias, so that must be wrong. So maybe Diodorus is right. But then you say, well, what's Diodorus' source? And we don't know what his source is. So as a historian there, we're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place where we can see reasons why one of the sources might be inventing or exaggerating, but we can't be sure of that. And so I think that that kind of source problem hangs over everything we do about Alexander. And it means that when each generation kind of come to Alexander, we see these sources in different ways, we interpret them in different ways. And I think we're kind of asking slightly different questions as well, which lets us explore different aspects of Alexander's life. Just, you know, as a changing contemporary attitudes and changing kind of interests within society prompt us to go back to history and re-examine things. You know, a good example that I kind of grappled with in the book is, should a battle narrative be exciting? right? Should we be trying to get a reader to imagine themselves on the front line, charging into battle with Alexander, kind of feeling the sweat on their brow and those kinds of things? If we're doing that, are we risking glorifying war or a particular kind of war? And equally, should we be looking more at what the experience and the attitudes of the people that Alexander conquered were? But the problem with questions like that is that those are the questions that our sources quite simply aren't interested in. They're interested in what Alexander was doing. So for us to get to kind of the perspective of the Persians or the Babylonians or the Bactrians, we either need to use different kinds of evidence, and there's a real limit as to what evidence there is from those kinds of perspectives, or we've got to read between the lines. And I think the big impact that that's had on the book for me is trying to be upfront with the reader about what we know for sure, what we don't know, what we can't know, and to try to give the reader a stake. And there's quite a few places in the book where I say to the reader, you know, this is my view, but you can have a different view. These are the different options. What do you think? And I think letting readers make up their own minds about this is really quite important.
You started off by bringing together descriptions or views of Alexander that you've drawn from things that have been written about him over the centuries, you know, and you frame it as, you know, a genius, a tyrant, a dreamer, a killer, a visionary, a maniac, Greek, not Greek, gay, not gay, a god, not a god. And you go on and then you end it with great question mark. And it really is a distillation of all the myriad of views about him.
Yeah, and that's what I was trying to do, express this idea that when people have looked at Alexander, it's tended to be through a biographical lens. When people are trying to understand someone's character and they're trying to boil it down to one characteristic or one defining feature which drove him as a person and which made him capable of doing the things that he did. And I think that that's quite a flawed way of writing history, right? And that's not how we are, any of us are as people. We're all complex people with lots of different factors and lots of different influences on the decisions we make. But I wanted to kind of give this sense of just how people could take the same evidence, the same moments, and come up with fundamentally different interpretations of his character. Yeah, absolutely.
And it is interesting what you say about wanting to explore the impact of his campaigns on the people he conquered, because it's very much taking it away from the biography and giving it this broad geographical sweep then that you're able to see where he's going, what is happening, and what impact his decisions are having.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's trying to find out the impact that Alexander has on people is so challenging, because nobody that he conquered really left any material evidence or written accounts of what happened. We've got some cuneiform written texts from Babylon, which are very short, and they're embedded into these chronicles or into what's called the astronomical diaries, which are essentially planetary observations. And we get these few little lines about things that were happening in Babylon during Alexander's reign and in the period afterwards. But we don't really have kind of hard evidence of what people thought. So I think my way of kind of grappling with that was twofold. I think, first of all, it was to actively try to think about the role of other people on his campaign. That's people within his own army, but also people who were on the Persian side and either worked with Alexander or who kind of opposed him. And I think when we talk about the impact on the conquered people, sometimes there's a tendency to just divide between the conqueror and the conquered, and to see these as two homogenous groups. And actually, there's a massive grey area in the middle that's really worth exploring. And the kind of example I settled on here is a woman called Aparma. So when Alexander gets into ancient Afghanistan, into Bactria and Sogdiana, he is faced with military resistance that's led ultimately by a guy called Spitamenes. Spitamenes is ultimately killed, but he has a daughter called Aparma. A few years later, in 324, Alexander has these mass weddings at the old Persian capital of Susa, right? And he marries two of the daughters of previous Persian kings, and he marries his leading nobleman, his leading Macedonian nobleman, to Persian women. And so Aparma is married to his general, a guy called Seleucus. And you can look at that story and you can see that as a story of a kind of young woman being snatched from her homeland, married off to this foreign conqueror, being part of kind of a narrative of sexual exploitation. But then Seleucus goes on to become the king of the biggest empire that grows up after Alexander's death. And Apama is his queen and the mother of his heir, Antiochus. And so she has this really interesting story where she starts out as the daughter of a nobleman who is part of the Persian kind of imperial hierarchy. All of that's sort of rolled away, destroyed by Alexander's conquest, and she's forced into this marriage. But then she kind of rises or sees her husband rise, and she ends up being the queen of the most powerful empire in the world, right? And it's a really interesting narrative that isn't just black and white in terms of the effect of Alexander's campaign on people or in terms of suffering or exploitation or those things. There's lots of grey areas there, and I think that's a really interesting narrative. And so I kind of was keen to explore some of that in the book.
Very good. Well, it's an extraordinary new book looking at the lives and legacies of Alexander the Great. The author, Stephen Harrison, the book called Alexander the Great, Lives and Legacy, part of that wonderful Great Lives of the Ancient World series, published in hardback. And Stephen, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Mairéis O'Sullivan. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.